Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 201, and we're going to talk about the 5-volt van. Can you do a complete build out without 110 volts, without 12 volts, and just USB? I think so. We're also going to talk about the new Mercedes-Benz e-Sprinter. Could this be the one that you can actually build out and go electric? And we'll avoid some glue when we're talking about flooring. Wow, that was a great intro, wasn't it? Anyway, we're here. Let's go with it. Thank you, everyone, for joining me once again. We're going to dive right in here. Now, so if you've watched enough YouTube and listened to enough podcasts and read enough articles, you'll know that sometimes people will create a piece of content that is nothing more than promoting a bunch of Amazon links. And I could be accused of that for this podcast, because I realized that I couldn't talk about possibility of building out a 5-volt van without having links to all the products that will make this work. And thus, this turns into an episode filled with affiliate links. I promise that that is not the purpose for this episode. I actually really like the idea of being able to do a build completely off of USB. And I think it's possible. And I've thought about all the different aspects. And well, here they are. And as it happens, yes, I will have an Amazon link to every single one of these things I talk about, but I don't care where you get this stuff. The links are there mostly for convenience. Yes, if you click on one of the links and buy something from Amazon, they do give me a little bit, and I will turn that money into buying more stuff, which I will use for product reviews. So, technology has changed quite a bit, and USB charging, which was never intended. You know, USB, the Universal Serial Bus Protocol, when it came out, God, around 2000 or so, I can't even remember how old it is, was meant for data. It's a serial bus. It's meant to move data from one thing to another. And then at some point they said, yeah, we should give it a little bit of power so we can power things that need power. Tiny little bit of power. Which was it the iPhone, the first one to use USB charging? According to what I can find, the first devices to use USB charging were things like MP3 players and cameras, things that were also using that cable for data. The idea that the cable would be just for charging had to evolve based on the idea of moving data. And evolve it has. Nowadays, almost everything is USB chargeable. I mean, that's not even close to being true. But, you know, at the end of the day, when I need to charge my stuff, my computer charges USB, my cell phone charges USB, my watch charges USB, I have flashlights that charge USB. I mean, USB, which is just 5 volts, has become a common way to charge all types of devices, some of which that have no data at all. I mean, data is just not even part of the calculation. I mean, my Apple Watch charges via USB, but it doesn't send any data over that USB. That's all done wirelessly. So when thinking about a van build-out, we typically have 12 volts, which is what the vehicle is. I think nowadays every vehicle has a 12-volt circuit in it. That didn't used to be true, actually. Jaguars actually were doing 6 volts for a while because they're weird. But now everything, even EVs, have a 12-volt circuit. So, you know, for years, that was the place to start. You do your stuff 12-volt. And then inverters became a little bit more reliable, and now it's not that hard to find rigs that run almost entirely on 110 volts because they invert that 12-volt DC to 110 volts AC. And, of course, if you're not in the U.S., you're doing your own calculations as to 220 volts or 240 volts or whatever you guys use. But now we're in this weird situation where there are so many USB chargeable devices that it's becoming feasible to actually do a complete build in 5 volts. And this would be specifically for no builds where you need to remove everything for some reason, like, say, the back of a truck or a cargo van you're actually going to use for cargo, or maybe a car or SUV or something like that, or maybe a tent or a utility trailer or something like that. You know, if you're going to build out a Sprinter van that you're going to travel the world in, a 5-volt system for your van would be supplemental. It wouldn't be the main way to go, because there are no 5-volt max air fans, for example. There are no 5-volt refrigerators. But for a lot of stuff, There is. So let's talk about the stuff I found, and you can give it a thought as to how much you want to do, because there's some advantages to using 5 volt, right? 5 volts, and when I say USB 5 volts, it's the same thing. So I'm not talking about two different things. USB and 5 volts is the same thing in my brain. There's all kinds of stuff available for them. The cables are readily made. You don't have to cut a lot of wires, or any maybe. There are switches ready to go. You can just buy them, and the whole thing is understandable. It's like Legos. Things just plug in, and you can totally understand what's going on. And you have a much lower fire hazard, because there's simply less energy going through the wires. It's not hard for 12 volts to cause a fire. It's not hard for 110 volts to cause a fire. 5 volts technically could cause a fire, especially with the new PD USB-C charging like my Mac uses. That's actually a lot of energy, but it's still less likely. So one of the most obvious things is lights. You know, lights, the changing in lighting technology has really made van life a lot easier for everybody because of LEDs. And there are 5 volt, aka USB chargeable lights now, or not chargeable. They don't have to have a battery. They just will plug into some other main battery you have, that are just perfect. They're dimmable. You can change the color temperatures, and they come in every possible configuration. They're magnetic, they're stick-on, they're spotlights, they're strip lights, they're everything. So lighting is fairly obvious. If you have not encountered USB lights yet, holy cow, they're everywhere. Now, that said, it's also true that 12-volt lights are everywhere too. And depending on how your build is, 12-volt lights might make more sense. But you can totally do lights with USB. There's no question. Another one that's a little bit more surprising is fans. There are a lot of USB fans out on the market now. Not any big vent fans like Max Air fans. I've not seen any of those that'll run on USB. But desk fans, personal fans, that type of thing. If you are camping in a mild climate, it might be just enough to take the edge off. And I travel with a couple of them. And like my lovely Venti fan, is USB chargeable. It is a USB fan, and it produces a lot of air and light. And heck, I can charge my phone with it too. So, I should put a link to the Venti in there too. All right, I will link the Venti, fine. I really wish they would sponsor me. Now, entertainment. I mean, the best device for entertainment on the road, in my opinion, is an iPad with a cellular connection. The reason being that you can watch literally anything on an iPad. Any streaming service you've ever heard of is available on an iPad. If you're in an area with weak connectivity, you can download things and watch them later. And if you have an iPad with a cellular connection, it's very easy to find an unlimited plan. So you don't have to worry about what you're watching. You just watch as much as you want. It's almost like the ideal situation for van life. And they're not inexpensive, and the plans aren't terribly cheap, but it's a one-and-done. You never have to worry about it. And if somehow you're the kind of person that doesn't need a full computer, an iPad can handle your computing needs. Basically, if everything you want to do is in a web browser, well, heck yeah, an iPad can do almost all of that. Now, I ran into some problems with some specific creator-type things that I really needed a computer for. Like, this podcast was problematic when I was just trying to use just the iPad. But that's something that you can mitigate. For entertainment, let's just say that iPads and probably the Samsung Android tablets as well would be a great USB chargeable solution for your van. What about heat? Heat's a tough one, right? Heat is the largest energy usage of anything you have in your van. Well, you're not going to find a USB heater. That is just not a thing. But you can find USB heating pads, USB clothing, the clothing that has little heating pads in it, and little hand warmer thing. It looks like a mouse, maybe, but it gets warm. And if you put one of those at the end of your sleeping bag down by your feet, it will actually help you a lot stay warm at night in mild temperatures. If it's 40 below zero, this is not the thing for you. But if it's, 45 and you're a little chilly, this might just take the edge off. And these things run USB. And some of them have their own batteries, and some of them you have to plug into another source, but we'll get to that at the end. What about cooking? Well, that's another heat thing, right? Well, there's a USB microwave. No, I'm kidding. There's no USB microwave oven. There are no USB ovens. There's no USB cooktops. None of that exists. cooking is going to be some other thing. You're probably still going to use butane. And just like heating, you know, I'm still going to recommend you have a diesel heater. But cooking's fairly easy to solve. You can cook on twigs. You can cook on sterno. You can cook on butane. There are little, like, cup warmers that you can get that work on USB. Like, if you heat up a cup of coffee and you want it to stay warm, you can get one of these little USB warmers. I think they're probably not going to help very much, but that's the closest we can get to cooking. Now, what about switches? Well, they do make these USB hubs that have a switch for every USB connection. So you can have one for lights, and one for fans, and then one for other things. And I've linked to one in the show notes that's actually pretty high quality. And you can turn off things you aren't using just with this one thing. So imagine you had this one central place that all your USB devices plugged into, and then you could turn them on with a switch. That is pretty convenient and actually fairly professional looking. And this one is very high power, so it'll handle things like your Mac and your or whatever computer you have that charges on USB as well. So that's something to consider. What about tools? I mean, I don't know about you, but I use my battery drill all the time for all kinds of things, and I have one in each vehicle I own because I use them that often. Well, yeah, there are USB rechargeable drills. Now, these are very low power things, and calling them a drill is kind of pushing it. They're really screwdrivers. But heck, a lot of the stuff you do to troubleshoot and to fix things on the road involves taking screws out and putting them in. So that's something you can do USB as well. How are you powering all these things? You know, it's like, oh, this is great, 5 volts. Well, something has to provide power for all this stuff. And while many of these things will have batteries built in, like the Venti fan, a lot of them won't. They'll be looking for power from a battery. Well, this is the beauty of the 5-volt system. You don't have to buy a big Jackery or wire in all this Victron stuff. You can just get some USB batteries, the kind that you would charge your phones with. There are 40,000 milliamp hour batteries now, and let's be realistic, that's 4 amp hours at 5 volts, that you can charge while you're driving or charge with solar or whatever, and then you can buy as many as you need. And they're like $15. So if you bought 3 of those, you could be charging 2 of them and using the other one. And you could probably get through the night with no problem. Now, talking about charging, some of these things, you know, even though we're only talking about 5 volts, it's a lot of power. Like my Venti fan takes a long time to charge. And that's just how the thing is. Not everything is PD, which is the higher level of charging. So that's something you're going to have to work out. For example, you probably couldn't use your Venti fan all day and all night. You can charge it while you're using it, but you would need to have some fairly robust charging. There are a lot of portable solar panels out there that have USB ports in them. You don't need a solar controller or anything like that. It's just the panel, and you plug USB directly into it. So that can help. But ultimately, what you're going to want to do is have some sort of way to charge from the battery in your vehicle while you're driving. So you would want a fairly hefty 12-volt socket charging or something like that. But that's not impossible. It is doable. And the way you would do it is you would have the 12-volt from the truck go to a cord that went to your battery, and then when you wanted to use the system, you'd unplug the battery, or you don't have to, depends on how the battery is configured, and you'd plug it into your USB switch in the back, and boom, you would have lights and fans and charging for whatever devices you needed. I forgot to mention water pumps, by the way. Yeah, you can have running water in a van. There's a lot of new water pumps that will plug right into one of those mini water bottle things. You know, like the water bottles used to have in offices, the water bubblers, they called them sometimes, because they'd bubble as you took water out. You can buy 2.5-gallon and 5-gallon versions of that, and there are pumps that just snap right on the top that run USB, and a charge lasts for like 2 weeks. So yeah, you've got running water too with USB. So this is not a solution for everybody. This is just something to think about that, yeah, you've got your 12-volt stuff. You'll always have that in a vehicle. And yeah, you can do 110-volt stuff if you're willing to install an inverter and everything that goes along with that. But for a lot of the lesser builds, the smaller builds, the no builds, you might be able to get away with almost entirely 5 volts. Van life news. Okay, back to EV vans. I mean, sadly, that is what most of the van news is these days in the U.S. because nobody's making new vans that aren't EV, and for better or for worse. I don't know what the future holds in the van market in the U.S., but it's pretty grim right now in relation to choice. We just don't have that many choices. But Mercedes is bringing their EV Sprinter to the U.S., and it's kind of looking like best in class at this point. It has all those nice things that people like in Sprinters, and it has one of those things missing that we don't like in Sprinters, which is the engine. So it should be a lot more reliable than most Sprinters. And the big thing is range. They claim 275 miles now, and if you buy the extra technology package, which is $3,500, you can charge it to 80% in 45 minutes. So, you know, I'm doing the math here, and I'm like, yeah, let's say you stopped every 200 miles for 45 minutes. I mean, it's not as convenient as an internal combustion engine, but it's completely doable. Depending on the kind of travel you do, that might work just fine. I mean, I know there are people that don't travel more than 100 miles from campsite to campsite. This could actually work. And then you've got everything going for you in the Sprinter, all the normal Sprinter stuff, the big, huge box in the back, the comfortable seats, the fancy controls, all that stuff. Now, this will cost you $85,000, and it is not four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive. This is just rear-wheel drive. And there are some complaints that even though they have a lot of torque, because they're EVs, EVs have a lot of torque, they can't sustain that torque for all that long. So you're fast off the line, but you're still kind of slow to getting up to speed. I don't think too many of us think in terms of 0 to 60 in van life, but from the review I read, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes, that was a little disappointing to the folks at Car and Driver, who I think have somewhat different standards than we do. 10 years from now, I expect many of us will be in EV cargo vans. I think that's what we're going to happen, and this is another step towards that, and arguably the best so far. Folks, there should be no ads in this podcast. I love that, and thank you guys very much for supporting the show and allowing that to happen. If you would like to support the show, you can visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo and give me a one-time donation, which I call buying me a gallon of diesel, or you can become a member and have a recurring membership fee withdrawn every month, and I will appreciate that, and so will everybody else who listens, because there are no ads. Tech Talk. A very specific topic for Tech Talk this week. When I was looking at Airstreams, and I promise this has to do with vans, when I was looking at Airstreams, one of the ones we looked at that we liked had a weird floor. There was just something odd about the floor. I mean, it had a little depression in it. Maybe there was some water damage. I don't know. But the edges were kind of siliconed, and it just looked wrong. And so I went and talked to the salespeople and finally found someone who knew something. And he said that the previous owner didn't like the original Airstream floor. And for this model, it was just a sheet of vinyl that was laid down, which I would argue is not a terrible solution. A single sheet of vinyl is waterproof, easy to lay down, requires some cutting, but you know, it's an inexpensive, it's a good floor. But this guy wanted something fancier, so he put down what looked like hardwood, but it was actually vinyl, and he glued it down on the floor. And I bet for a week it looked really nice. And then it started to move around, and the glue started to heat up and come up between the seams. And by the time he was ready to trade this trailer in, his floor looked terrible. It looked so bad that he had to spend over $4,000 to have the floor removed and to have the original floor restored back to the way it was from Airstream. So the lesson from this is, if you're considering flooring, avoid adhesives. If you're going to do some sort of a hardwood kind of thing or fake hardwood or vinyl, try to find a floating floor system. Those are very common in households, and they do have some problems. I mean, there can be some buckling and things like that. But floor adhesives are not used to the temperatures that we find in vehicles, and they will melt and seep up, and things will move, and just be careful of that. When you pick your flooring, know that you can make mistakes there. Make sure your whatever you use for flooring, if it's not a single sheet, make sure each tile is very, very tight up against the next one. In fact, I would look for flooring that locked together. That would probably be best. So avoid using adhesives on any type of flooring that is not single sheet, because it could come back to haunt you. Product review. Well, 10-4, good buddy, we're going to talk about Citizen Band radios. That is CB radios, which back in the 70s were all the rage. They made movies and TV series about these things. Everybody had a handle. Kids were buying them. Everybody had a CB in their car. It was all kind of silly in a way, but it was also kind of cool too. I mean, this was before the internet. This was before we could send each other email and stuff. And I had friends in my neighborhood who would just sit and chat on the CB all night long, just like they were in a chat room. So yay, it was, you know, it was pretty cool. But these days, while most trucks do have CBs in them, the truckers aren't using them like they used to. They don't even have them on half the time. So CBs are not as useful as they used to be. Except in a case which I think is very important, is that if you're driving down the road and then something's wrong, like traffic's backed up and you don't know why, if you turn on the CB, you'll find out instantly, because the truckers will talk to each other and say, yep, we got a big wreck up here at this mile marker, get to the left or exit here. And that is invaluable advice, and it actually saved me just recently, because I installed a CB in my ambulance and I was able to avoid a tree that fell across I-75 that was causing all kinds of problems. And the only way I would have found out about this was with the CB. So the CB I got, I think, is actually kind of perfect for van life because of how it's designed. It's the Uniden CMX760 Bearcat Off-Road Series. And this is a full-featured CB with weather channel and all 40 channels and all that kind of stuff. It's got digital squelch, which I'm not a huge fan of, but that's okay. But the entire thing, all the controls are in the microphone. The part you hold in your hand, everything's there. And there is a transceiver, the box, that has all the guts in it, but you can hide that away. So the only thing you have in your van that you see is the microphone. And it comes with a cord extension, so you can actually mount that to your dashboard, say, but also stretch it into the back. So if you had somebody else with a CB radio, you could talk to them. And they do make portable CB radios. I mean, you can use these things to talk around the campground or whatever. Now, this one that I got didn't take very long to install, but you'd have to know that when you buy a CB, you also have to buy an antenna. Now, my ambulance had an antenna already installed. It is completely the wrong antenna, and you should never use the wrong antenna. But, you know, I used to work with two-way radios, so I'm going to, because I am one of those do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do kind of people? I don't know. Anyway, don't worry about me. Worry about you. Make sure you buy the proper CB antenna to use for this thing. And that can be a little challenging, because CB antennas are quite big. They make gutter mounts. They make some window mounts, but not too many. The most best kind requires you drilling a hole in the roof. And if you don't want to do that, then yeah, go with the gutter mounts or the mirror mount ones. But anyway, just remember, when you buy this radio, it does not come with the antenna. Now, having used this a little bit, even with the wrong antenna, it's completely, totally, 100% usable. And the sound that comes out of the microphone, because the speaker's in the microphone too, was totally hearable at highway speeds in my Sprinter, which is not a very quiet vehicle. I did also buy the auxiliary speaker, which is just a bigger speaker, and the sound is much better with that, but it absolutely isn't necessary. And so, if you ever thought that, you know, maybe you'd like to have a CB in your vehicle, which is a great way to talk between two different vehicles, or to find out what's going on if there's a huge traffic backup in the interstate, this one, I think, is probably ideal. It's not the cheapest. It's $120. You can get them for $80. But again, everything is in that handpiece, and that flexibility, I think, makes it great. And for installation, all you need is 12 volts and the antenna connection. You can plug it into a cigarette lighter or any 12-volt source in your vehicle, and then the other cable goes to the antenna, and that's it. So this is the Uniden CMX760 Bearcat Off-Road Series Compact Mobile CB Radio. I like it. I think it's great, and if you've ever thought of having a CB, this is definitely one to look at. Tales from the Road. So growing up in Salem, Massachusetts, which was kind of a fantasy place to grow up, Salem is just one of these little tiny cities that it's like if you had a play school city set, this city has all that. There's the ocean, and then there's the hills for hiking, and then there's the downtown city area, and there's the woods, and there's some farms. I mean, it's got everything that a little tiny city is supposed to have. And one of those things is a seaport, and the seaport has some lighthouses. And one of those lighthouses is on Winter Island, which I've mentioned as a good camping spot. If you want to visit Salem, Mass., with your van, go ahead and look into getting a spot at Winter Island, a fascinating historical place to camp. I've done it. It's great. And there's a lighthouse there. And back in the early 80s, they were renovating the lighthouse, and they invited the kids in Salem to come help move bags of sand, basically. They had to sandblast the whole thing, and that uses a lot of sand. And they were just having us as cheap labor. They actually paid us in arcade tokens, if you can believe that. But I went down there and volunteered for that. It's an interesting spot. It's next to what's called Waikiki Beach, because during World War II, I guess they were Coast Guardsmen, but they might have been Navy. It was a PBY base, so I don't actually know who they worked for, but they referred to this big sandy beach, which is fairly rare in that part of the state, as Waikiki Beach, because it was actually a really nice beach. Anyway, there was a geologist there, and he was there just because he was interested in the area. I don't think he was necessarily involved with us fixing up the lighthouse, but I got a chance to talk with him, and he mentioned that the rocks we were standing on, which were very black and had these little red crystals in them, were the same rocks that you would find in Africa directly across the Atlantic Ocean. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he pointed out that at one time, way back in the times of Gondwanaland, Africa and New England were attached to each other. And these rocks that we're standing on were part of those same rocks that are still in Africa today. And then over millions of years, they spread apart and created the Atlantic Ocean. And even though they're thousands of miles apart now, they're the same rocks. And I thought, wow, that's cool. Wouldn't it be interesting to go and visit the rocks on the other side? And I did. This last trip I just took to Spain and Morocco, which is right just south of Gibraltar, I went to those rocks. And I couldn't actually walk on a complete analog of the rocks because, you know, erosion and things had changed. But on the west coast of Morocco, there are these black rock cliffs, which are kind of amazing because the cliffs are like 75 feet above the water and people fish from the top of the cliffs. So they're casting off there, and once they catch a fish, once they get it out of the water, they still have to reel it up 75 feet, which is pretty impressive. But yeah, those rocks are the same rocks that you could find in Salem, Massachusetts. They're from the same geologic process that produced that giant rock or bedrock or whatever the heck it is. Kind of amazing given how far away Salem is from Morocco, how very, very different the cultures are. And then little things like Salem is a word in Morocco that people recognize, and we're walking on the same rocks. So, you know, maybe we're not all that far apart after all. A place to visit. I have not been to this place. I may not ever go to this place, but it's something. This is in Washington State, and it is the Mermaid Museum. Now, they advertise themselves as the world's first international mermaid museum. I happen to know that that is not true. Not only are they not international in any way that I can tell, they're not the first either. There are other mermaid museums. But it doesn't matter, because this one exists. And it was started by this couple who used to run a big dive shop in Honolulu and now run a winery in Washington. And next to the winery, they built a mermaid museum. And folks, if you like mermaids, this is where you want to go. The building itself is held up by mermaid caryatids, which you would want to look up if you didn't know what that was. And inside, they have everything you can possibly relate to mermaids, including Fiji mermaids, which are the P.T. Barnum mermaid gaffs, technically, that he showed in his museums. Yeah, you can go see one there. They have helmets from people who dove on the USS Arizona after World War II. They have live mermaids. They even have one of those big Zoltar machines, like from the movie Big, except it's a mermaid. It's called Aquamarine Speaks, and you put money in and she will tell you your fortune. I don't even know what to think about it, but they are very serious about this, and they will have people there dressed as mermaids to greet you. And one of the owners said that she always wanted to be a mermaid, and so she thought she'd make this museum. Folks, it's $3. It's $3 to see this. And in 2024, they're having a mermaid festival from April 6th to April 14th. It's a 9-day event. And from 11 to 6, they're going to be open, and it'll be free to visit. So the world is filled with strange and interesting places to see, and this is certainly one of them. So this is in Aberdeen, Washington, not too far from the coast. They have all kinds of, they emphasize this, day parking for RVs, boats, and buses. It even says, merfolk of all ages and animals specifically trained to aid a person with disabilities are welcome. So if you have your service mermaid with you, it's okay. They can come visit this museum. I'm not sure the same would be true of the Smithsonian. Resource recommendation. I have mentioned the YouTube channel Simple Enough before. It's a young Muslim woman who is doing the nomad thing on her own, living in her vehicle, and one of the things she does is gig work. She supports herself with gig work. And she made a great video about the realities of doing gig work out of your van or whatever vehicle you're living out of. Because there are some challenges, right? You're not going to be able to do Uber or Lyft in your van. I mean, I think you might sort of could, but I don't think Uber or Lyft is going to approve that. And heck, you know, when you show up with an Uber, you might have three people who are going to get in. You may not have space for three people. So that doesn't work. But there are other gig work things you can do with a van, such as delivering groceries for Instacart, or just using your van to drive you to actual jobs. There's all kinds of gig work that is just day work at factories. And one of the common ones, and I've seen this a few different places, is assembling sandwiches for gas stations. And now gas stations have theirs. Not all that great sandwiches for sale. You know, there's like egg salad that you're like, how hungry am I? If I eat this, I might end up in the hospital, but I'm really hungry. You know, those kind of sandwiches, and probably sushi too, that, well, they often use day workers for those, people who come in and work for the day and get paid at the end of the day. So she goes through a day of doing this and what her life is like, and it's all done on her phone, it's all done with apps, and she starts the day by looking at the apps and seeing who has the best offer. And of course, there's a rhyme and reason to it. There are some things to learn, there's lessons to be had, you know, there's certain, like, you don't want to do the $3 McDonald's fry delivery and you're going to make 20 cents for driving 10 miles. You don't want to do that one. But if you find three $10 deliveries in the same apartment building at the same time, that can be worth it. You know, little things like that. Anyway, if you were ever curious about what it was like to do gig work while you're living in your vehicle, watch this video. I'll have a link in the show notes. The channel is called Simple Enough. Well, folks, you squandered another perfectly good... Oh, I can't say that. That was taken already. Thank you very much for listening to episode 201. I absolutely appreciate it. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. As a reminder, we do have a Facebook group, and we do have a Discord channel, and you can find all that stuff in the show notes. And until next time, remember the words of Confucius, who said, "By three methods we may learn wisdom. First, by reflection, which is noblest. Second, by imitation, which is easiest. And third, by experience, which is the bitterest."